This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. People sometimes think that there are no unexplored places left on Earth, but there are still explorers, and wildlife biologist Alan Rabinowitz is emphatically one of them. He's scaled the remote highlands bordering the Himalayan mountains. He's tracked jaguars in Belize and leopards in the rainforest of Thailand, all with one goal in sight: to preserve vast tracts of wilderness as habitat for endangered species. Rabinowitz is the director of the Science and Exploration Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society, based at the Bronx Zoo. He's the author of a number of books that read more like scientific adventure stories than nature writing. They include Jaguar, Chasing the Dragon's Tail, and Beyond the Last Village. While Rabinowitz has researched many large mammals, he's focused primarily on large cats, leopards, tigers.
Jaguars are considered one of...
and is in the process of trying to establish a corridor of protected habitat for jaguars that would stretch from Mexico to Argentina. This project is the subject of a National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar, airing November 26th on PBS. I asked Alan Rabinowitz what distinguishes jaguars from other big cats.
Jaguars are considered one of the three great cats in the world. They're the third largest cat after tigers and lions, and they're considered one of the top predators in the entire world. In the Western Hemisphere, they are the largest cat, and they're the top predator. So they're a major focus of my research, and always have been, because by studying the thing that's number one, that's the top of the food chain of the ecosystem, we can get at everything else below it. So when I do research on jaguars, find out how large an area they need to live, how large a space we need to protect them, what I'm actually getting at is not just trying to save jaguars, I'm actually trying to save intact whole ecological systems or ecosystems.
Where can jaguars be found in the wild now?
Currently, jaguars range from northern Mexico to northern Argentina. They used to come up into the United States. We do have recent evidence that some jaguars are actually coming from the Mexican populations over the border into southern Arizona, southern New Mexico. So jaguars may, in fact, be able to come back in the southern United States at some point in the future if we protect them. But currently, they reside from Mexico to Argentina.
Well, does their species face more challenges or different challenges to survival than other large cats? Are they in a category of their own in terms of that?
In some ways, jaguars are in a category of their own. Saving them presents a lot of the same challenges that saving other large cats does in terms of saving large areas of habitat, trying to stop people from hunting them. In some ways, saving jaguars is a bit of an easier task than, say, trying to conserve tigers, because we're dealing with almost one uniform cultural unit where jaguars occur throughout Central and South America. Whereas with tigers, we're dealing with fragmented populations scattered over many different countries with different languages and political systems. But they're tougher to protect in that they occur in areas where there's a lot of human conflict, a lot of private land. It's not as easy to buy or set up large protected areas for the jaguars as it is for some of the other cats. So it's a balance.
You say in the National Geographic documentary that one of the problems contributing to the jaguars' endangerment is that people think they're more dangerous than they really are, maybe because we don't know as much about them. But what have you observed in the field that makes you so sure they're not really that dangerous?
Well, beyond having actually captured numerous jaguars and followed them, followed the ones which I've captured and radio-collared myself through the jungle for years, I've actually tracked jaguars numerous times, and on at least two occasions, I turned around to return to my camp, and the jaguar I was tracking was, in fact, right in back of me, tracking me. It had circled around, and I know this because I went back the next day and actually followed the tracks of the animal I saw right in back of me, and it turned out to be the same jaguar, which had circled around and was simply walking in back of me for quite a distance, and I never even knew it was back there. It could have attacked me, it could have made some kind of vocalization at any time. But it didn't, because basically it was curious. It was following me to find out why I was following it. And often people will tell stories about being stalked by them or being followed by them. Well, in actual fact, jaguars are curious, and in all likelihood, the jaguar was following them out of curiosity, because if a big cat like a jaguar wants to attack you, you probably will never see it coming. And if you even see it coming, it'll only be seconds before it hits you that you'll see it coming. So to be aware that an animal is following you or close by means it's not really trying to get at you.
Well, I was just going to ask you that, because it's so intriguing what you're saying about the jaguar's curiosity. On the other hand, it's so creepy to know you're out there.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can know it's really an interesting thing, especially when I would try to call jaguars, and at night I would actually sit up in a tree or sometimes at the base of a tree and use a jaguar caller, a special instrument made by the local people, which is supposed to simulate their vocalizations. And you would know a jaguar was coming in when all of the night sounds would stop closer and closer. They wouldn't stop all at once. You would hear them stopping in the distance and then stopping closer and closer to you, but you would never see the jaguar or never hear the jaguar. And then when I heard all sounds stop around me, then I would turn on a flashlight, and more often than not, there would be the jaguar right there looking at me.
What do you mean right there? In a tree nearby or what?
No, either I'd be, usually it'd be me who was in the tree. I'd be in the tree only once I actually couldn't get up in a tree, and we stayed down on the ground, which I didn't like very much. And the jaguar would come within about 10 feet and I could see it and it could see me, or sometimes it'd be in the rainforest around me and I could hear it walking around trying to figure out what I was doing once it realized that I wasn't another jaguar.
Okay, now what happens the moment after you shine your flashlight and you see the jaguar looking back at you?
Only once did the jaguar actually make a vocalization, which I don't even think was an aggressive vocalization. Simply, I think it was a bit pissed off at me. I think it was annoyed that I had brought it in, and then it realized I was just a human being. But usually, just like when I've encountered jaguars in other situations, it would look at me curiously, trying to figure out something for a few seconds, and then it would simply walk off into the jungle. I'd be shaking. I'd be pretty scared, or at least humbled. Not always scared, but just feeling like I was in the presence of something much greater than myself. And I would be frozen, and it would just walk off as if it just had other business to attend to.
I'm talking with Alan Rabinowitz. He's a wildlife biologist and a conservationist. His work with jaguars in Central and South America is profiled in a new National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar. It airs November 26th on PBS. I want to talk about some of the conservation work you've done in Asia. And I know you've worked to preserve wildlife in Burma. It's known as Myanmar. What's happened to the tiger population there? That was the species you were looking at.
Working in Myanmar has been one of the most incredible experiences of my life. I've been involved there since 1993. It's going on 10 years now, and it's been one of the most adventuresome and rewarding experiences in my professional career. That country always fascinated me, as well as many other biologists, because for the region of Asia, it has more forest left in it than any country in the Indo-Pacific realm. And in the past, it was thought to be home of about 7,000 animal species or more. Potentially, from the amount of forest which it had when I first went there, I thought it could have, or did have, the second largest tiger population outside of India, with the potential of having more tigers than any other country in the world. That started off a lot of other research over the years, but we did spend about 3 years surveying tigers throughout the entire country, which is not an easy task. Most of the tigers have been killed off in the country by local groups who were funneling the tiger parts mostly over the border into China for the Chinese trade in traditional medicines. But they did have some tigers left. We estimated that the whole country had perhaps 150 tigers left, which is pitiful for a place which once had hundreds of thousands of tigers in the past and still had lots of forests left for tigers. But it was good data to get, because that spurred us on and spurred the government on to try to do something to reverse this trend and do something about it. And that led to what I'm involved in right now, which could be one of the greatest conservation accomplishments of my life, and I think could be one of the best models in the world, setting up a tiger reserve of approximately 8,000 square miles in northern Myanmar by the India border, which will be by far the largest tiger reserve any place in the world, and has the best population of tigers left in the country, which could potentially expand outward and fill the country up again.
While you were in Myanmar, you made a 500-mile trek across lands that very few Westerners have traveled in. So what kind of terrain were you going through, and what kind of cultures did you come across?
Well, that area up there it's a fascinating terrain because, well, it's incredibly mountainous. It's the southeast edge of the Himalayan mountains. It's where the Himalayas end and smack up against what's called the China Plateau to the east. It's one of the most unknown areas zoologically in the world because nobody has been allowed up there because of various politics. Even the government itself wasn't. When I went up into that area, not only did the local people say it was the first time they had seen a Westerner, but it was the first time they had met a central Burmese person, a Burman from the capital city area, because people from most of Burma couldn't get up into that area because of insurgency. And only in 1994 was a peace treaty signed with the local insurgents so that it was open to other people in the country. But the terrain was incredibly rugged. It was just walking up and down. There was virtually no flat area to be walking. You were either always going uphill or downhill. And you would try to stay in villages. There were local villages back up in there, small settlements. They were always in the river valleys, in between the ups and the downs.
You've written a book about this trek, Beyond the Last Village, and in it you write that in many of these villages, their greatest necessity is salt, and that they, at least one peoples, eat a meat of a primitive species that's little known outside the region.
Yes, in fact, well, there are two things there. One was the fascinating fact that this is one area of the world where there are no natural sources of salt to be found. And you really realize how important salt is to the lives of human beings, although we take it for granted, of course, because salt is on every table in a restaurant. But in this part of the world, people will die without salt. People hunt for salt. People base their lives around obtaining enough salt for the year and obtaining it for themselves and for their livestock. They will often spend months out hunting rare endangered species to trade with Chinese traders just to get salt. So it was a very interesting thing to realize, as well as opening up a lot of doors for me when trying eventually to figure out how do I protect this area, how do I help these local people, what can we do to both help the wildlife and help the people. Salt became the major issue. Now, in terms of what the people eat, it was fascinating because not only are they up in this area, since we did the first zoological survey, we indeed found many rare endangered Himalayan species like red panda, which people know about, occurring there in abundance, but also some species which people know almost nothing about and have not even heard of, like takin or black barking deer. And we even discovered a completely new species to science, the second smallest deer in the world, which the local people called the leaf deer.
So I have to ask you, how small is it?
The leaf deer stands full adult size. It stands about 20 inches, and it has antlers, which at their maximum size are only 1 inch long. And the people call it leaf deer in their own language. It's called pedji, which means leaf deer, meaning that when they kill one of these, they could wrap its entire body inside of a single large leaf of one of the local plants they use. And in fact, I ended up going back the next year because during that first survey, I didn't really have time other than finding parts of this new species and realizing there's a new species up here and then getting it identified genetically back in New York. But then I went back the next year with my wife, who's a geneticist, and we stayed among that group of people who hunted this deer and actually watched them and studied them alive. And that was just an incredible experience.
I know that as a child you suffered from a severe stutter, and that's in large part how you came to do the work that you do. When it sounds exhausting, when you're working when you're working in the field, do hours and hours, even days perhaps, go by where you don't have to talk? Is that like a respite for you?
Yes, and that's partly why I chose my field initially. It's a very complex... I chose my field partly because I loved animals and I felt a special bond towards animals, and I chose not only to work and study animals, but to run away to the furthest reaches of the world, not just to go in my backyard or stay in the United States and study animals, but I wanted to study animals in the furthest hidden away spots and cultures where people didn't speak English. So I didn't have to talk to them, or I'd learn another language, and I thought perhaps I won't stutter in another language, or to where I would just be alone in the jungle or in the forest following animals for days, weeks, months at a time, and barely, if ever, have to speak to anybody. That's exactly why I did it, and it's exactly what happened. For years after first going out into the forest, I would do just that. I would stay with animals, I would radio call them, follow them, live in the forest, and I wouldn't have to speak to anybody. Sometimes there would be local people around me, but we would communicate using hand signals if I didn't know their language. When I worked in Thailand, I eventually learned Thai. And that's when I learned over the years that if you speak well enough in a language and you're a stutterer, you will stutter in that language also. Because there came a day when I started stuttering in Thai as well.
Fate is so cruel.
That's right. But that is exactly why I was drawn. It's a fairly complex reason. So many people have an easy answer when asked, why do you do what you do when it's working with animals? And they answer, because they've always loved animals for their entire life. Mine's a very complex answer because it involved a lot of different things, both in myself and in my relationship with animals.
I know you were diagnosed 2 years ago with leukemia. How is your health now?
I was diagnosed with leukemia, with a slow-acting form of leukemia, chronic lymphatic leukemia, which has no known cure to it right now, but also can progress very slow. It can speed up also. They don't know. It's just a big question mark how much longer until I might need treatment for it.
Well, when you got your diagnosis, did your doctor sit you down and say, look, we know you trek through Burma for your work and you track down jaguars and tigers. That just has to stop.
Actually, no. I was very pleased. The doctors were a bit stymied. They said, you know, normally when we diagnose somebody of your age and at this early stage with leukemia, with this kind of leukemia, we tell them to just go about life as normal and don't change anything in your life. But your life is not normal, they said to me. They said, you've got us a bit stumped here because we want to tell you, go about your life as normal, but the fact is that if you get sick, because I've often got, from all my years in the field, I've gotten very sick on numerous occasions, because there's no way to live with local people for such a long time as I do and not get things like malaria or typhoid or dengue or scrub typhus, and I've had all of those things. And what the doctors are worried about now is that it's possible, though they don't know if this will definitely happen, that if I get very sick again while I'm out in the field, it could speed the disease up. It could, since it kicks my immune system into overdrive trying to heal myself, it will create more white blood cells and it could speed things along. So they were caught between saying, look, go about life as pretty much normal, but try hard not to get as sick as you have in the past.
How much time do you spend in the field now?
Well, it was only when I was 40 that I decided to take some time off from the field and get married. And since I've been married, actually it's since I've had my first child at 46 in the last few years, I've cut down a bit my time away in the field. Now I spend maybe 6 months a year in the field, whereas before it was virtually 95 to 100% of my time.
Well, I just want to say I really enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you Godspeed and good luck with your work.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a true pleasure to speak with you today. It's been wonderful.
Wildlife biologist Alan Rabinowitz. His work is the focus of a National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar. It airs November 26th on PBS.